The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for At Long Last Love from 1975. If you do not wish to have this movie spoilt, please watch it before listening to the following podcast. Is it a forgotten classic, or at long last, should it be forgotten? We watched At Long Last Love from 1975 to see if we could redeem it. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Boy, oh boy.
Is it too good to be bad? So bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? Got bad. I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy.
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project podcast, this time checking out At Long Last Love from 1975. I am one of your hosts, Trevor Holland, and I am joined by my good friend, co-host and suggester of At Long Last Love,
Christian Fletcher. Sorry, I was waiting for the title to be even longer there. Thank you, Trevor. I think it threw me. I was about to, I don't know, put myself in the sin bin by saying that I suggested this movie, but you included it there. So thank you for having me back.
All good. Well, if it wasn't for you, we probably would never have gotten to this movie because to be honest, I had never even heard of it before you suggested it. So, yeah, it was definitely a new experience for me.
Yeah, well, it's one I've always known about, and you've probably heard of, obviously we've heard of the Raspberries, but I think an earlier part of that was the Golden Turkey Awards, I think, from the late 70s, and I've often saw it listed in those books, always in the top 50, this forgotten musical from Peter Bogdanovich, who didn't really do that sort of stuff, so, and with obviously a cast list that's quite impressive, so yeah, I thought we'd bring out this movie that I think that even Fox was embarrassed to release on Blu-ray until recently. I don't think it had even been available on DVD or any way that I don't think anyone, honestly, Trevor, I think we're probably the first two people to be talking about this movie for the first time in years, so yeah, so I thought we'd mix things up a bit this time.
All good. Now, we did mention quickly the cast, and I think we probably should get this out of the way, in that this movie does star Burt Reynolds, who did sadly pass a week or so back now. Now, those who did listen to our previous podcast, that was recorded before the announcement, before we found out, so... I don't know if we call it an unfortunate coincidence that we happen to be doing a Burt Reynolds. I don't think it's as unfortunate. I mean, I think it's fine that we're doing a Burt Reynolds movie, but certainly the selection of it,
it was more
of curiosity about the movie.
Yeah, it wasn't done in any way to, I suppose, cash in's not the word, but, you know, to, yeah, the fact that he'd passed away, it was sort of a serendipitous, I suppose, decision a few days earlier. So I think the fact that, as I said, I'd been reading about a bit, so maybe it was a sign, I don't know. So let's find out whether it was one that Burt Reynolds should be remembered for.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's probably, we won't dwell on that, so we'll move on. And now, if you haven't seen At Long Last Love from 1975, don't worry, you're probably not alone. But I dug up, it was hard to find a synopsis of this one because everything I could find was basically a summary of the entire movie, which I didn't really want to do. So instead, I've got this tagline, a new kind of musical with 16 great songs.
Oh, well, that says it all. And that was, it's funny, a big thing in the 70s was promoting the amount of songs within the movie. And I suppose the big thing about this being the soundtrack of Cole Porter. And I believe, you know, and I don't know if it's based on my knowledge, but I believe they did pick a lot of the lesser known songs. You know, there's probably a couple in there that you obviously are quite iconic. But yeah, I think they've gone the lesser known Cole Porter songs. So.
Yeah, I will say I recognise a couple of them, but yeah, I mean, really, two maybe at most that I knew. Some of the stuff that sounded kind of familiar, but yeah, I must admit I'm not too big on the Cole Porter songs, so Yes, again, was very much a new experience for me on many levels.
For someone who's run a lot of classic movie mornings and all sorts of events like that, I can see why Peter Bogdanovich, I'm assuming that's how we pronounce it, was quite a big fan of 30s musicals, and you can see why this was obviously intended to be a tribute or a pastiche to that genre of filmmaking, even in the camera angles and different ways that he chose to film it. And a really unusual, this is probably digging into the trivia a bit earlier, but the unusual process of recording the vocals live on set rather than them having the cast mime to it, which was quite an unusual decision as well.
Absolutely. Yep. I can cross that trivia off my list. That's all good.
I probably stepped ahead of myself there.
No, it's all good. Now, you did mention the awards. Now, I mean, the Golden Turkey, I think, was like a book series that almost was released every year. So it hasn't come up with any official awards in IMDb land, but certainly, yes, it was featured in the Golden Turkey books back in the 70s quite prominently.
And that's probably how any knowledge of this movie continued, because I'm sure it pretty much opened and closed. I believe the box office was abysmal for this.
Yes. Well, funny you should mention that, because our next step is to talk about our turkey trivia.
Aha.
So we can talk turkey and continue with the trivia. So this one is rated 4.9 out of 10 on IMDb. It had a budget of $6 million, and the box office was $1.5 million.
Ooh, and even considering the stars that are in this film, to have only brought in $1 million is pretty bad.
Indeed. I know, but we know Bette Reynolds was in there. Was Sybil Shepherd a particularly big star at the time? I don't feel that she... I've all thought she was more of an 80s,
well, yeah,
late 70s, 80s star.
Like, I did a bit of, before I watched the movie, I did a bit of research, and yeah, apparently, you know, because I know she did Taxi Driver in 1976, and she had quite a big role in that, sort of, I suppose, as the love interest of Robert De Niro, and yeah, apparently that was her big breakthrough. So yeah, I was thinking she was a known actress by this stage, but I don't think she was in this movie, so it seemed like it was pretty much Burt Reynolds around a lot of, I suppose, rising and unknown actresses, even though that said, you've got Madeleine Kahn, I think, she either won or was a nominator, but for the Academy Award for Blazing Saddles, which was 74. So she would have been fresh off the Academy Award.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you mentioned about Sybil Shepherd being a rising star. Well, my first bit of trivia is that Peter Bogdanovich considered playing Pritchard, the Burt Reynolds character, so he could star with his then girlfriend, Sybil Shepherd.
Uh-huh.
He offered the role to Elliot Gould, who turned it down before Burt Reynolds accepted it.
And we probably, I was going to say, we wouldn't be here now, but yeah, anyway, that it was a serendipitous choice. But yeah, that's interesting. I have read that she may have been in a lot of his movies around that time too, before she sort of hit the big time. So quite interesting. So yeah, I think Burt Reynolds was a good choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't know if this is any indicator of what they called it the movie, but apparently Cole Porter started writing the lyrics to the song At Long Last Love while waiting for medics to arrive after being in an accident which left him partially paralysed.
I remember reading that and thinking, oh, well, it's interesting that all these years later they used this as the title of a movie. I don't know if that was maybe jinxing it before it came out. Perhaps.
I am not too sure. Now, the only other trivia that we haven't already covered that I've got for this one is that Burt Reynolds once said of this movie, "I think we bombed."
Based on that box office, yeah, I'm getting that. But it sounds like he was a good sport about it anyway. But, well, the part that I found interesting, and I don't know if it was on the recent, I think the soundtrack albums, you know, how they've done in recent years, sort of limited edition soundtracks they've released finally. And this movie's had it, but because all the audio or the vocals were recorded live on set, there's not actually an isolated version of the song, so that it has all the sounds of people's feet and people dropping props and all sorts of things. So apparently it makes for a terrible soundtrack experience. So it's an interesting, so maybe not the best process for them to have used.
Yeah, definitely an interesting choice, yes.
Yeah.
Now, before we talk too much more about the movie itself and any apparent quality of the singing, we do need to set our baseline. So here on the Rufus Project, we do take movies with less than stellar reputations or performances to see if they can be redeemed. But to do that, we need to set a baseline. So I went to Amazon and I dug up this review to see what we're working from. The title of this review is Like a Bad Penny. At Long Last Love is kitsch at its most garish. It's an attempt to recapture the 30s movie musical ethos with an altogether wrong cast of characters. It was panned when it was released in 75 and thought to have been put to rest, but like a bad penny, has stubbornly returned in a new format. 1 star.
There we go, somebody who's not too happy about the Blu-ray release.
No.
Oh, well, it can only go up or sideways from here, but I think it echoes. I'm sure there would have been quite a lot of bad reviews to dig through on that page, Trevor, because, yeah, it seems to be a unanimous decision from what I read.
Well, interestingly, about 59% of the reviews were positive. So
that's interesting. So
yes,
I'm sure we'll hear one of those at the end, but we'll get to that.
Yes, we'll get there. We'll get there. But yeah, I was quite impressed that in 1975, a two-hour movie is almost like a rarity. It's very odd for them to push that sort of running time.
Yeah, like as I know, it's, you know, it's funny because even if they're trying to, I suppose, pay tribute to the 30s, even those movies weren't even that long. So yeah, I did look at the running time and go, oh, it's on the cusp, but thankfully it didn't feel as bad as it could have. But yeah, it did seem like quite a long movie, but I was really impressed to see straight into it the Fox logo. That even, like, at first I thought there was something wrong with my TV, but the Fox logo was even tinted to look like it was in the 30s. And yeah, it's interesting that you're thinking, oh, is it going to be a black and white film?
Yeah, I mean, the nice elegant Century Fox logo and the nice elegant Art Deco titles with the golden music box and the sparkly mirrored things.
That didn't do that's the thing. I was looking at it going, oh, they're not really doing too much, but you watch those 30s movies and there is usually just some something like that in the background with the credits playing over the top. So yeah, it was quite clever, and as we see later on, what those you know, those music boxes, and you see the couples dancing with each other and then swapping, we're pretty much shown the plot in those couple of minutes, really. So you're going in, essentially, you know, if you are going in as a viewer, you are, yeah, there's not too much plot to worry about. It's probably more about the music.
Absolutely. And I mean, I was surprised watching those opening credits because I didn't do any reading or anything before I went into this because I was trying to go in as fresh as possible. So I had no idea that Madeline Kahn was in it. And to be honest, I am quite the Madeline Kahn fan. I always find that she does put in a great performance, and when she rocks up as one of the first people you see and does the first song as a drunk socialite who's just been dumped by her boyfriend, it's like, okay, this is promising. I can maybe get into this if this is the sort of thing we're going to be looking at for this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they picked the perfect person to obviously to play the part, but to open the movie. And it's so funny. You notice, you know, a lot with a lot of the other musical numbers, a lot of them are done in one take, and you realize how much of a fantastic performer Madeline Kahn was, actually. And even right down to the last note, ending up with the alcohol on her face, you know. But it's funny. Just about every production number seems to be people either entering a door or walking out of it, or, you know, or into a room or something like that. But yeah, definitely think it was a good way to open. And yeah, I know what you mean. I felt like, you know, even though we find out it's not completely sung, I think it's one of those ones where you felt like I could really even, you know, get into this if it was completely sung.
Yeah. And just some of the strange dialogue. I think, what was it? She calls the dude a duck and a weasel. What? Doesn't make any sense, but okay. Oh, look, you're Madeline Kahn. I'm going to go with whatever you say, and honestly.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, I've got a little note for later on, but it's so funny how all of that Cole Porter music, like, I'm assuming they haven't changed any or much of the lyrics, but it's all got that sort of that innuendo about it, and a lot of quite curious things we find later on when they're, you know, comparing, I don't know, a person's love life to an object, and I don't know. It's just very very much of that that era, but yeah, that's why I think they've picked the songs that, you know, might not necessarily be as popular, but I suppose tell the story.
Yeah, the songs they picked certainly fit right in with what they were doing. I think basically the script was written around the songs.
Yeah.
Given that there was very like any build up for a song was like very much just put into place and crowbarred in there, just so you could then say after Madeline Kahn have the Italian Lothario turn up and play his game of poker, and then go off singing through the streets, or was it Johnny Spanish? That was his name.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't. That was the only character I didn't get. I've just got Italian guy, even though, as you said, Spanish.
Yeah, and even at a point where he's singing, he turns up at a newsstand. It's just like, oh, it was like a Italian stereotype versus a New York stereotype. As he's singing to this this newsie in the streets of New York, he said, "Just want a bar of it," which I found quite a funny thing. And there's a few times in the movie actually where I think at one point Burt Reynolds basically stands up and says, "I'm going to sing a verse," and Sybil Shepherd goes, "Do you have to?"
Well, that's what I find interesting. I don't think it's probably until the second half that it's not that sort of musical where they, you know, the entire chorus in the background all dance in song. It's almost like these leads do all the singing and everyone else is almost like, oh god, they're breaking into song again. I don't know, and I think it worked quite well because it was almost like these people are so love struck they just exist in their own world. But yeah, I do believe I know what you mean. It's almost like the songs really are just hooks. I mean, sorry, the dialogue are just hooks to put those songs together, you know. And yeah, I honestly probably could have handled no dialogue.
Yeah, what I could have handled was a bit more colour, because I don't mean this in a... I mean, obviously the cast, except for one token character, is all white as white can be, but everything in this movie was so white. I was just even looking at Madeline Kahn's apartment at the start, thinking that would be a nightmare to keep clean. All their clothes are always white and the walls are white. Brett Reynolds has got a white Rolls Royce. It's like, should I be watching? Should I have sunglasses on with this? Because it's just so white.
And I think it's like they've done that to sort of give it that feel of being a black and white movie. And I think one thing I noticed was, yeah, most people are wearing white except pretty much anyone who plays a servant. So it's almost like they're trying to, pinpoint them as being the leads. But like, even you see them, you know, get out of their white outfits into their white satin, I don't know, bathing suits even, not even what they wear to bed. But I do know what you mean, and I think it was actually a conscious decision of the director to film it like that.
I'd say so. But then you're saying the servants, I mean, what was the relationship of Sybil Shepherd's friend to Sybil Shepherd?
Oh, do you mean
I thought they were just friends, yeah. but then later on she's dressed in a full maid outfit at Burt Reynolds' house. And she doesn't even work there. Why is she being a maid at Burt Reynolds' house?
Well, yeah, it took me a bit to work up, but I think I've worked out it's her personal maid. Like, I think she must have a wealthy... Because, yeah, we find she's got a wealthy mum, I think, like that. So she must have, you know how, you know, sort of in that era, you know, they'd have a carer or a minder or something like that. So, yeah, and I think when she went, she ended up with that guy and moving into that mansion, she just became the maid there as well. Yeah, it was quite strange because, you know, how she ended up doing the cucumbers and, you know, getting all that stuff organised. But, oh, you know, how convenient, the servant falls in love with the servant.
That was making me very, very uncomfortable after a while. What was it? Was it Elizabeth?
I'm not sure. That's one I didn't have the name either, too.
That's
the Eileen Brennan character, is it?
Yeah. Elizabeth being Brooke's personal maid. I didn't get that.
Yeah, let's just say that.
What was the person? But her pursuit of the butler, Rodney, that... It got to the point where it's just like, this guy keeps telling her no, and she keeps coming forward, and, you know, it's stalkery, creepy-ish behavior, and I really needed to stop, even though I know at some point he's just going to give in to her, but she is making me, like, she made me so uncomfortable.
She honestly, and it might have been the first few scenes, probably because I didn't really know what her part in the movie was, but she felt like probably the odd one out in terms of she was in a totally different movie than what the rest of them are. But yeah, you've got that whole bit where he keeps insisting, you know, the driver that she ends up falling in love with in the car, he keeps insisting, no, it's... So he preferred being called Rodney, and they kept calling him Rod, but then I noticed later on even... But Reynolds would call him Rod, and was very confused about that. But yeah, it's like they're all jammed in a car. They're all sort of split off into their couples, and it's just the obvious choice that because she's sitting in the front seat, she'll end up with him as well. Look, I don't think too much thought was in, and that's the problem, is there's not that much substance in this movie with that sort of style.
Yeah, very, very true. I've also... another common thing was when people started trying to have conversations with them while they were singing.
Especially with
it's just almost like, or they'd start incorporating some of the lyric as a reply to what they'd asked or said, and it probably wouldn't necessarily work.
Yeah, I mean, because I think early on that Elizabeth character is trying to tell Sybil Shepherd's character, Brooke, that they're being kicked out of the hotel. And she's just completely oblivious because she's singing her song. So I was like, don't bother talk to the singing person, you know. Just let them finish and then talk to them, because you're not going to get anywhere with them.
I think that's what, like I mentioned earlier, how the people in the background don't join in the songs. I think it's only not until later on when they go to that racket club ball with all the with his mum, which I thought was quite strange. How Burt Reynolds' mum pretty much asks him to come with her to her, let's just say, her oldies ball to help her find a date. I thought that was a bit weird. And let's drag along everyone else so we can have a double date there as well. But like, you'd notice too that they'd stop and be singing. One, I think that was a section, where Madeleine Kahn's singing off in the distance in one side of the room with her arm up. Sybil Shepherd's in the other side of the room dominating it. And as soon as they all run out the room, the song finishes and the ladies in the band just put their stuff down. It's like they dominate every scene. Nothing else can happen.
Yeah, and the whole friendship song that just kept on going forever, to be honest.
Oh, yes.
It was like they're at a club and everyone's dancing and everything like that, and then they start up their song and start doing their routine. And like everyone on the dance floor just basically forms a semicircle around them while they do their thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, they've got this audience that's just standing there passively staring at them. It wasn't like they were getting into it. They were just like there, just going, okay, we have insane people here. Let's just stand back and let them do their thing in case they decide to hurt us.
But then I think, would it have worked better if that all joined in and it had been like a big production number? Like, I'm thinking it's an interesting choice, you know, and it's probably also showing why, you know, the director has never directed a musical before, you know. Remember, we sort of encountered this with The Wiz with Sidney Lumet, like kind of that real camera in one position. And that's what I noticed, you know, just about all of this was done in one take. And that real common thing of pulling the camera back and pretty much just filming them from top to bottom, no cutting away, you know, while you've got the two ladies doing something in the background and then Burt Reynolds and the other guy would do something in unison behind them. So, yeah, I don't know if it's going for a style thing or just, yeah, not a knowledge of the medium.
I mean, potentially, it could have been trying to do stuff like, you know, they were performing on stage. I mean, there was that interesting side thing where I'm guessing that the song they wanted to use couldn't be fitted into the general plot. So they had the one scene where Madeleine Kahn was appearing in a Cole Porter production just so she could sing that caveman song.
Oh my God, literally with cavemen on it. And it's funny because I'm like going, this is odd. But then you look at the reactions of the people in the audience and I think that they think they're watching Springtime for Hitler, I think.
Yeah, they cut back and everyone's just there looking with the glazed astonishment on the face, including like Burt Reynolds, Sybil Shepherd, and
the other two,
Johnny, and Rodney. There you go. Okay, fair enough.
But it just seems to be another way to sort of, as you said, give a performance or use that song in another way. And it's interesting. I'm actually probably thankful that they didn't have more production numbers because they could have ended up as unusual as that one. So. But that sort of leads the way. We find out that Madeleine Kahn went to school with Sybil Shepherd, and it sort of sets up the whole, I was going to say love triangle, but love square, I suppose. And it's just interesting. And they just happen to stop every now and then and have champagne. And how weird that they're playing football and suddenly Burt Reynolds' mum comes in with the football and scores a goal. It's just this random moment. And then, oh, while we're here, let's have champers on the grass. Oh, to be rich.
Yeah, but did they ever stop drinking? That was the other thing too, is they always seem to be at least partially inebriated.
Well, in their defence, if you saw how much the guy poured, there was barely a mouthful. But I love how earlier on how Madeleine Kahn, you know, we said she did that drunken song and then she went out into the street and she almost gets knocked over by Burt Reynolds. And the next thing she says is, oh, I'm not drunk anymore, and just goes back to normal. And I'm like, oh gosh, you bounce back fast.
Yeah. But with all that Madeleine Kahn charm, which, again, I'll say straight out now, Madeleine Kahn was my favourite thing about this, so.
Oh, and she seems to same everything, and that's what I love, that one scene later on where the guy dances, and she's like, I don't think I can do that. You mean this? And then almost, you know, it's like, step aside, you know. So I don't really know her background before film, but I'm sure she's a triple threat, or was a triple threat, because she definitely seems to light up the screen and saved a lot of the rest of the movie, because, as much as the other leads were quite, were good, they were very one note.
Yeah, well, it seemed like for a while there, and it's particularly like in the final third of the movie, it focuses so much on Burt Reynolds and Sybil Shepherd that she even like occasional appearances by Johnny, she almost disappears for this big chunk of the movie towards the end before just reappearing because Sybil Shepherd happens to bump into her when she's shopping.
Yeah, which I thought was a weird scene as well. Like, it felt like we were sort of about 10 or 15 minutes from the end, and okay, let's go shopping. And here's me thinking, where's this going? But I actually really appreciated that scene. It kind of injected the movie with a bit of energy, when it was kind of lagging near the end. Because, as we said earlier, being a 2-hour movie, it could have been, say, half an hour shorter. But it did seem like they kind of wrapped it up in that last 5 minutes really, really quickly. But I don't want to go too far ahead to the end, but yeah, another big thing would probably be, probably the reputation for this movie would be the singing voices. And look, Trevor, I didn't actually find them as bad as people were saying, but I think we're also conditioned to hearing, seeing movies like Mamma Mia, where, a lot of non-singers are in musicals now. So, I don't know, seeing it from a new perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was fine. I mean, some of the higher, more aggressive notes were a bit on the warbly side. But then again, I know that they weren't singers, and I found Burt Reynolds, he had his Burt Reynolds charm and in full swing behind what he was singing, which gave it a bit extra. And Madeleine Kahn, of course, she's a consummate, comic singing performer. From like you said, from Blazing Salads,
Saddles. Interesting movie.
A lot of the, like, that Mel Brooks style stuff.
She's very much a character, a fun song. Character actress, I suppose. Yeah. Too. And one thing that I one thing, probably one of the only positives I'd ever read was Sybil Shepherd actually has quite a nice voice, and I found it quite pleasant to listen to. And you could still put it alongside, Meryl Streep or someone singing in Mamma Mia. Like, it wasn't nails down a chalkboard,
Yeah, it was fine. It was fine. I did find, well, after a while, I did find Sybil seemed to be very much a single level, basically, shall we say. Her performance didn't really seem to vary much after a while, whereas the other ones, like the other people, still seemed to be acting along with their singing.
If you know what I mean. And a lot of times, and you do wonder if a lot of it was to do with the fact that they were singing live. Like, some of the segues, it would have been, jarring for a performer, but like, you'd have scenes of her in the, like, early on when with Eileen Brennan, when she's in the bath and she gives her that note and she's singing along, and I'm thinking, well, this, for an actor, where they actually have to hit the notes while they're lying in a bathtub live, like, it, you know, that was pretty daring for that, for 1975.
Yeah, well, there was also she got a bit risque a few times with her dress and exposing a bit of extra skin. I think there was even a point later on where a couple of porters come in because she's pining because Burt Reynolds has said, "Oh no, I actually love Madeleine Kahn," even though that they've been dating since that weird racket club night. And it's just like, oh, okay, so yeah, the whole thing where Johnny and Sybil teamed up and Burt and Madeleine paired up, but then at that record club suddenly Burt and Sybil are together, and off go Johnny and Madeleine, and it's like, okay, fine.
Yeah, because it didn't, they, like, yeah, because they came in and they said, Burt Reynolds said to his mum, where are they? Oh, they wanted to leave you two alone, and they pretty much fled and had their own sort of scene. But then I think we saw later on, or in the next part, they're sort of waving each other farewell at, kind of paying tribute, I suppose, to Casablanca, or, that kind of style of being left on the train while the other person runs off. But yeah, it got to that. I just felt that because we were near the end that they were just, it wasn't wrapping itself up as best as it could have. It was almost like they'd set up this scenario but didn't really know how to solve it. How do we get them back to the other side? It's not a music box where they can just spin back to where they were. So that's what I kind of got that feeling at the end. So it could have been a bit tighter in that respect. But as we said, it was pretty much the dialogue was there for the musical numbers.
Very much so. The dialogue and plot was an excuse to sing songs. I mean, that's probably the only really way you could sum that up.
And look, there was a lot of, just looking at also too, the production, I suppose, musical numbers, there were some clever ways, like even though I think he was definitely going that sort of 30s feel of, the camera in one place while they, danced around the room, that was very similar. But there was a couple of little touches, that at the end of a song, like they'd fall behind the bed and knock the lamp over, which would set the scene to dark. Just think little touches like that. Or I think there was one part where, very, very suggestive, I think it happened a couple of times, where Burt Reynolds and Cybill Shepherd go behind the couch. But then the next thing, the fire just goes woof and just flames up even more, and then the scene cuts. So there'd be a lot of little touches like that. So I don't know if he was, supposed to be being clever with that, but it definitely, I don't know, it's definitely not the MTV style that we're very much used to with a lot of those sort of Baz Luhrmann and those sort of newer musicals. So, so it was very much paying tribute to that style.
Yeah, the transitions and the setups and the transitions were quite good, even if some of the songs themselves, let's just say, not a lot happened for songs that seemed to go on for a very long time as we got, into the mid to end bit of the movie. I mean, the whole thing where Sybil's trying to, get Bert to misbehave with her, that just kept on going and going and going. I mean, there on the couch, he's turning on lights, she's turning it off as she follows around. Then they had the whole thing where they go swimming for no apparent reason. Yeah. And then they're in this, then they're next to each other in adjacent dressing rooms. And finally, we get to the bit where they go, okay, it's time to misbehave now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could have done that like 5 minutes ago and we wouldn't have lost anything, guys.
But that said, like you mentioned them in the swimming pool. I don't know, there's something about that scene. You can really, there was a chemistry or... Actually, yeah, was is the term. There definitely was a chemistry between Burt Reynolds and Cybill Shepherd in that movie. I don't know, they just seemed like they were having a lot of fun, but it is quite weird. Again, imagine being in a pool splashing around and having to sing your vocals live. It was quite weird, and whilst the whole time I think Burt Reynolds is being flicked in the face with his goggles or whatever that weird thing. Was it a nose plug or something?
Yeah, like a nose plug.
And I don't know, for the next 5 minutes, Cybill Shepherd, or he'd just been readjusting that. So it was almost like they weren't given too much to do and were just trying to be a bit natural rather than that whole typical song and dance number. Like, yeah, it's supposed to seem a lot more like, hey, we're just singing a song and leaning on a bar, or,
Yeah, because for a lot of this movie, I mean, there were exceptions, but for a lot of this movie, the chemistry, like, seemed better between the two male leads and directly between the two female leads rather than the chemistry between them as couples.
Yeah.
You know, they really did, like, there was one point where after Bert and Cybill ran off, and they keep cutting to all these things that Bert and Cybill are going to, and at every single place there's Johnny and Madeline. I should stop mixing up the names, but it's too late.
Yeah, it's
now.
All good.
At every single place they are, there's Johnny and Madeline just making out. Like, pretty much in the exact same location in front of them, just in front of them and to the left every single time, and until Bert gets up and taps Johnny on the shoulder and they go off at the movies or whatever to the men's room where they appear to have a fight, but then they come out arm in arm, arms around each other's shoulders, having a great time and a good laugh.
Maybe you
it's
can
like, what did you guys do in that bathroom?
I was going to say, maybe you could read a lot more into that. And then, it's funny you mentioned that, because there was that scene I said earlier where they were playing football and they all ended up on the grass. I think it ended up as all six of them pretty much having a picnic. And the way that the director has positioned them all, Cybill Shepherd's leaning into Madeline Kahn, and one of the guys is lying back, and I think actually, yeah, Burt Reynolds is lying back, and the other guy's lying next to him, like they're a couple. It was a really odd, like I can understand they were doing it, to create a sort of a tableau for the shot, but it was a really weird thing. But yeah, I do know what you mean. So maybe there's a whole nother movie there.
Yeah, a whole thing that he wanted to do but couldn't at the time. Maybe I don't know.
But I did, like you mentioned, how they'd bump into each other at different things. I love how they used every 30s cliche. There always has to be the baseball game with people eating popcorn. And I don't know if you noticed in that scene. I don't know if it was done on purpose to sort of give the film that, I don't know, I was going to see that rhythmic sort of feel or like a musical. But the people behind, the guy would hand a piece of popcorn to the girl next to him, sit for a bit, the girl next to him, then the next person down, and just keep repeating that. This is the guy sitting behind them at the baseball game. So, I don't know, maybe just an extra following orders.
Yeah, the extras weren't given a lot to do. Yeah. They'll basically just be in the background because, you know, this is our entire focus, are these couples that just continue to be drunk. And I think they all, like Burt Reynolds was rich and everybody else wanted to be rich.
I was going to say they were spoilt and rich, but if they weren't rich, they were just spoilt. But it's funny, like, yeah, it's almost like all the other people in the movie were standing back going, oh, let these people have their moment. But, you know, like almost looking at them in disgust. But we did mention earlier where they went shopping and they end up bumping in Eileen Brennan and Sybil bump into Madeline Kahn. Obviously, they had character names, but in the powder room. And I really, really appreciated that scene. But I thought it could have been a real big musical number. And instead, they've got all the women just looking through the doorway, trying to, you know, watching them all dance. Yeah, it was like everyone always had to separate because the stars are doing their thing. Very last line of it, or the last two words of the song, all the women sing a line and then it finishes. And it's just like, But, you know, they did do clever things. Like, it was all the reflections of them were shown in the mirrors behind the women. So it was kind of clever little things like that. But you're like, you could have made this a big production number and actually incorporated your extras in some way.
Yeah, that was like after that song and then they had the walking in the park together song with Sybil and Madeline, or should I say Brooke and Kitty.
Oh my God, we're actually referring to their names.
I thought I'd better do it at some point. Hey, I'll do it again.
It took me about an hour into the movie to realise what their names were anyway.
It's all good. But that it was pretty much at that point that I'm thinking, you know, I would be more convinced by this movie if the two female leads are the ones that end up together, you know, because I feel a much better chemistry. And this is after, like, Madeline had disappeared for a big chunk of the movie. And to be honest, at this point, I was just finding nearly everybody in this movie was just starting to get on my nerves because I just seemed so obnoxiously self-centered that I couldn't actually believe that anyone would fall for them at this particular point, even though they're all pining over each other.
Yeah, they almost
but you know, all pining over the other person, as opposed to the person that's pining over them, because oh, look at that. Oh, love
can solve everything, you know.
Yes,
even the rich and spoiled can be happy, even though, as we said, the wannabe rich. But I love how, you know, you mentioned earlier how Sybil's moping around the house because and she doesn't want to answer Bert's calls, but as soon as she gets away for $1 million, she's like, oh, but then Eileen has to go, come on, you can go shopping, you've got $1 million, and you're like, have a bit more, you know, have a bit more enthusiasm, Sybil. Oh, I've got $1 million. But then she's easily swayed and goes out shopping. But yeah, it's almost like these people deserve each other, actually. But by this stage, not that I should be judging it on the length, you know, as I was watching it, but I, you know, that's why I think it could have been, you know, half an hour shorter. It just felt that that last 20 minutes, half an hour was, you know, trying to flesh it out a bit too much and, you know, just needed to be finished.
Yeah, because...
Or wound up or solved.
Like I said, yeah, some of those songs just went on. There was a particular song that kept on going where it was just basically... Eileen Brennan singing to Rod, saying, you know, what about doing some shooting? No, I don't like shooting in the morning, no.
Oh, and then bang it back.
It was just like, it kept going and going and going. It went too long for what it was. And then, yeah, it came back later on when it was nighttime, so it made no sense. Yeah. And then she just jumped him anyway, and that was them getting together. I was like, no. No.
And a big thing about those, because I think even they reprised that a couple of times, you know, that was kind of their signature song. But another thing, a couple of numbers, I think it might have been even two or three, that every couple had to at least sing two or three verses of the song. Like, you think the song was over, it would go to a scene of then Madeline Kahn with the other guy, and they'd have to sing a verse as well. So it almost ended up these quite long production numbers. It's funny because I've looked at the soundtrack, and based on what we think the amount of songs in the movie, there's not as many in there. So I think it's very much, you know, a lot of repeated stuff.
Yeah, because they had the whole big friendship number, which was cute for a while, but just kept on going, unfortunately. And then when they come into the big scene where they all end up going to the dance together, and obviously, you know, the guys have the partners they... I was trying to remember. Basically, the guys are with the partners they want to be with, but of course the girls want to be with the other guys, with the other guy. But as they're going in there, there's like this little musical sting, and it's a reprise of that friendship song. So I thought, oh, okay, here's a little bit of foreshadowing. But then that doesn't actually go anywhere. They're forced to swap partners by the guy running the dance.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it just kind of finishes with just them dancing as those partners that they swap to, as if everything's worked out okay for the girls. But yep. I mean, I know I'm at the end of the movie here, but then it comes back to that music box, and that music box has a thing where the little women figures swap, and they stop and freeze halfway across. So it's like, does that mean that the girls gave up and the guys, what's going on? I don't know what's going on. Oh, it's finished.
But at the end of the day, Trevor, what a swell party this is. Like that whole scene, I'm assuming that, I think that is the scene where they pretty much get swapped.
That's a record club, yeah.
And then I think it's actually probably one of the, believe it or not, one of the first time non-leads actually participate in a group number and sing a line. Like, I do love how you've kind of got the old guy going, what a swell party it is. And I think, like, Bert's mum decides that, because like, the guy she's been paired with is really boring, and he's like, oh, what a swell party this is. But yeah, but too little too late. But yeah, that was one of those situations. It's like, oh, let's swap and let's just sing a musical number, be happy, and go to the next scene. Yeah, it's quite strange. Or a lot of cases just dance out, or as you said, everyone sort of has to part while all four of them do this big routine. It almost feels like going to a club and your friends have just decided to break out and do this dance, and everyone's standing back. Oh, do they do this much?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest, Christian, I don't think we've talked about this one for that long, but to be honest, I don't really think I've got anything else I can say about this
movie.
Yeah,
I'm thinking the same too. I'm going all over the place.
Yeah, because it basically is, let's force in some plot and dialogue to justify this song, and repeat. So if you're happy, I guess we'll just move on to the next bit. So now you did pick At Long Last Love from 1975. So I shall go first with my thoughts as to any redeeming features in this movie and if it's redeemable overall. And look, I've got to be honest, it did start with a certain charm. And there was certainly a bit of a sense of fun there, and it just seemed to be an excuse to sing songs. And most of the characters I found shared that initial charm until the point where, and I put this in quotes, the plot kicked in. Once they got into, I suppose, the meat of the movie and setting up all these relationships and having songs that really did seem to go longer than they needed to, it really... I felt like a lot through that middle thing, through the middle of the movie towards the end, everything was really, really starting to be dragged out. Jokes were being dragged out. Songs were being dragged out. And the minuscule plot was being dragged to breaking point. So to be honest, by the end of this movie, any goodwill I had towards it was pretty much worn away and I was exhausted. I didn't really have an issue with anyone's performance. But by the end... three of the four characters I found were so unlikable that I gave up caring about them entirely, and I just wanted Madeline Kahn to be happy. And really, by the end of it, I can't redeem it, Christian. It just ended up being too painful towards the end, and I just gave up and saw it out. purely because I had to talk about it on this podcast.
Yeah. Well, well done making it through the 2 hours and 3 minutes. Interesting. So, well, yeah, well, I was trying to keep my thoughts on this movie, you know, sort of under wraps. But, yeah, look, I didn't know what I was going to expect going in. And obviously, based on the reviews, you know, I wasn't expecting too much. But, look, I think the thing is, if this movie was made now by someone like Baz Luhrmann, it'd sort of have the appeal of, say, Great Gatsby and all those sort of films. And I think it was, not saying this movie was ahead of its time, but I think it just came out at a time that probably wasn't suitable. And the way that it was filmed in terms of, you know, the live vocals and things like that probably didn't work for it. I think this would have worked a lot better as a shorter film and even completely sung through. Look, I found, in terms of the singing voices, you know, not as bad as the reputation of what you hear about is true. And, you know, you're definitely, you know, right. Madeline Kahn steals the show, but I found all of the leads quite stellar. And, you know, Burt Reynolds, the late Burt Reynolds, was definitely suave and sophisticated and definitely pulled off the role well. Peter Bogdanovich, you can tell, was a fan of 30s movies, and I definitely think he captured the feel with, you know, that real 30s feel, and definitely with the costumes and the set design. So without beating around the bush too much, Trevor, I actually really enjoyed this movie much more than I thought I would, and I'd probably even sit down and watch it again. I don't know if it's the 70s lover of in me, or I maybe felt sorry for it, but yeah, I actually would definitely find this movie redeemable.
Ooh, a split decision for At Long Last Love.
I didn't think I'd be saying that. I was regretting I was regretting having to watch this, you know, or dreading having to watch this, but I enjoyed it.
There we go. Well, that's fine. That's why we definitely need the two voices on this, because I know that we do have different tastes. So, so anybody out there who's not sure if they need to watch this, I'm afraid we can't help you. You're going to have to make up your mind for yourself. But, you know, I didn't redeem it. Christian did. That's all good. And this movie does indeed have its fans. So we do like to finish on a nice high note, or a high point. So I did go back to Amazon to dig out a review to wrap it all up. The title of this review is A Buried Treasure Unearthed at Long Last. Before I read this further, I will say there are stuff in all caps, and as we all know, all caps on the internet means that they're shouting, so I need to read this appropriately. Okay, ready? Wow! I have been wanting to see this for such a long time, and it was finally announced that Fox were releasing the definitive version. I was over the paper moon. I ordered as soon as I possibly could. When the disc arrived in the mail, could not wait to put it in the player, and let me tell you, it did not disappoint! How anybody human could hate this film is beyond my means of understanding. Peter Bogdanovich's work of a genius is finally available for all to see, and I, for one, completely adored it. I watched it 4 times in a row. It has now shot up my list of favourite films all the way into my top 10. Very highly recommended indeed! And P.S. I love Madeline Kahn! 5 stars.
Well, we can say we echo the last statement at least.
yes, we can.
But I'm just getting over the fact that they watched it 4 times in a row. That's 8 hours of it. Long last. Oh god! Look, I liked it, but yeah, I'm not raving about it. I just want to get that clear. Like that.
Fair enough. Not 4 times in a row and shout on the internet.
Yeah,
liking.
Exactly. But thanks, Trevor. Buying that for us.
That's all good. So. So, okay, well, I think that wraps up At Long Last Love with our split decision. Ooh. I know, it's always, I find it thrilling when we have a split decision. It's like, ooh, this is juicy. Anyway.
Especially when we want to know what's going to happen next.
Absolutely. That's where it comes down to me this time around to talk about our next movie. And I've got a bit of a setup on this one. I'll let you know why. So I'm going to jump forward a whole 5 years to the dawn of the 80s. And now it's story time, so sit back and enjoy yourselves. A few weeks back, I was treating myself and checking out records at the local markets when I came across a double album soundtrack for a movie I had never heard of, produced by a very well-known name. I checked out the track list and so very happily purchased the soundtrack, We are talking about Suzi Quatro, The Pretenders, Talking Heads, Ramones, XTC, and even more. A lot of post-punk awesomeness, let me just say that. I popped it on the record player, I opened the gatefold, and spotted the first name in the cast list as well. So immediately I wanted to know why I had never heard of a movie with such a good soundtrack and this particular leading man topping the bill. I did a bit of research, discovered that it had bombed badly. Bad reviews, bad box office, the works. I then found the full movie on YouTube, was about to start watching it, and then I thought of you, Christian, and how much you would not want to miss out on experiencing this with me.
I know exactly what movie you're going to say, Trevor.
Well, we are checking out the 1980 Robert Stigwood, yes, Grease, Tommy, Sgt. Pepper's, Lonely Hearts Club Band, Robert Stigwood production, starring the very awesome Tim Curry, Times Square.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing it finally because I have a friend who's a big fan of the movie and said to me years ago, I've got the DVD, I'm going to lend it to you. She lent it to me. I've never watched it. It's still sitting in the room right next door to me. I've never got around to watching it. And I've got to return that DVD soon, Trevor, so I couldn't think of a better time for us to watch this. I think I watched about 10 minutes of it and got distracted and never went back to it. So seems like the perfect time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying. I mean, obviously, I don't want to give myself any expectations, but having 1980 Tim Curry as a late night DJ in a film about two girls that escape from a mental asylum and form a punk band, I mean, how with that soundtrack, I can't understand how this movie cannot be good, but I know that I can't think that going into it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't remember anything about it. So, I think it's definitely time for me to dust off that DVD and watch it.
and return it after all these years.
Yeah, exactly. So I better like it if Lisa's listening.
All good. Okay, excellent. So I'm glad you heard of the movie at least because, yeah, like I said, I came across the soundtrack that's going... What is this movie? And the more I dug, the more it's just like, I've got to check this out.
I knew it had a big soundtrack, but I didn't realize it was a double LP.
Oh, yeah. I've listened to it like 3 times since I got it. It's great.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to it. So
there we go. So, yeah, again, this is another one that, to be honest, if you want to go looking this on the normal digital mediums, it's basically... available nowhere from what I can see, but like I said, the full movie is currently watchable on YouTube without much searching, so you know it's out there. If you want to check it out before our next podcast, please do, because we would love to hear your thoughts on it, or if you've got any comments about At Long Last Love. So if you do, it's very easy to get in touch with us. You can find the Rufus Project at rufusproject.com on the internet and leave comments below this very episode. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook with the Rufus Project on YouTube. You can send us an email to podcast@rufusproject.com. We make it super duper easy for you to get in touch with us and let us know your thoughts.
Wow. So I suppose we're keeping the musical theme going, I suppose, indirectly. So...
Yeah, we are. I think it's a different type of musical. But yeah, definitely music stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, so, I want to listen to the soundtrack again now. I'm just thinking, I've really got to listen to that again. Anyway.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the movie and hearing the soundtrack.
All good. So from obscure movies from 1980 to... cult classics from across the decades. Christian, I understand you've got a few pretty cool events coming up very, very soon. So would you like to let us know what's happening in the Christian Fletcher events land?
Yes, definitely. As I'm looking at the fact that we're in September, wow, there's not that many months of the year left, but the cult classics keep coming. We've got talking about Eileen Brennan and Madeleine Kahn. We've got Clue from 1985, actually with Tim Curry. Trevor, that's another serendipitous little triangle there. So very clever. That's happening on the 28th. We're also doing the 50 50th anniversary screening of Barbarella with Jane Fonda. So hard to believe it's been 50 years. And I think Jane Fonda's been trying to forget it for 50 years. We also have other films for Halloween, such as The Hunger, Lost Boys, Poltergeist, and in November, Office Space, Desperately Seeking Susan, Tank Girl, and Showgirls. And there's also one of our last retro parties for the year, which is a 60s and 70s night on the 20th of October. And a David Bowie event in early November. So, and for more details, check out christianfletcher.com or Christian Fletcher Events on Facebook, because there's too many to mention here.
Absolutely. And while you're checking things out, check out our sister podcast, What the History, which is at wthpod.rufusproject.com. That's where myself and my wife Susie get a couple of bizarre bits from history to make you say, "What the History?" Normally only about 20 minutes long. We are on a bit of a break as my wife goes and gallivants across the globe. She's over in England at the moment, but she will be back and we'll be recording more of those, including, I think our second birthday episode will be coming up very, very soon too. So that's a great one to check out, and definitely get onto the Rufus Project YouTube channel. I myself have been insanely busy over the past few weeks, so there hasn't been too much going up there fresh, but I definitely have more things coming on that as well. So we've got lots of stuff for you to enjoy here at the Rufus Project.
Definitely, and so from history tidbits to bad or good movies, depending on how you look at it, so we've got you covered.
Absolutely. So I think on that note, it's probably time to wrap things up. I think we're probably wrapping up a bit. Oh no, we're sitting about an hour. That's a bit abnormal. Wow, I thought we talked less about the movie. Oh, well, that's
we're
all
halfway
good.
Through the movie length anyway.
There we go. So we hope you have enjoyed this, and we're back in a couple of weeks' time to talk Times Square from 1980. So even if the movie's not any good, I'm sure the chat, as always, will be awesome. Thank you so much, Christian.
Fantastic. Thank you. Looking forward to it.
And we'll see you all next time.
There are 8 million stories in the big city. People say I have a bird's eye view, perched up here night after night, looking right down into the heart of the beast.
Yes, stop comes with me.
Will you get in the car?
Yes, it's story time. This is Johnny LaGuardia. It's that kind of night and that kind of feeling.
Pamela, this is Dr. Huber of Columbia Presbyterian, professor of neuropsychology. He's attending this morning. Very privileged to have him here with us.
I was in a car crash, or was it the war? But I've never been quite the same.
Pammy and Nikki, they've had it with being looked after. From now on, they're going to run the show for themselves and find themselves some dreams.
All right, breathe, Mo, I'll bring your balls out. What are you laughing at?
You said bring your balls out.
Out on the street and out of the night, they have a message for the city. And they're going to be heard on Times Square.
I don't see why we need to be famous.
You know a lot of things. I only know one thing, and it is that they're going to see who I am.
Apathy, banality, boredom, television. But a new iconoclast has come to save us. It's the Sleaze Sisters. It's Nikki and Pamela. Go to it, girls.
Get out of here! This is my place! You all leave visiting! Out!
This is Nikki Marotta, famous murderer and entertainer. I'm throwing a concert tonight in Times Square. Celebrate my escape from mental illness. Don't miss it.
It's coming together.
Pammy and Nikki found each other and themselves on the streets of New York. Now, the whole city is going to share their exhilaration. The venue will be Times Square.
Creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. I'm BB, says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Redeeming features.
Through your brain, I'll complain.
It's friendship, friendship.
Just about every friendship.
When out there, friendships go off the smoke.
Ours will still be oak.
La, la, la.
Cluck, cluck, cluck.